This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll discuss what we're starting to learn about long COVID. And we want your calls and questions. Our number, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK if you have questions about long COVID or you want to share your own information. But first, you know, it either seems like yesterday or a very long time ago, but it was actually 2 years ago today that the WHO declared COVID-19 a pandemic. Later this month, Hawaii will become the 50th and final U.S. state to drop indoor mask requirements. Those and other COVID-19 protections have been tumbling down nationwide as the winter Omicron surge has eased. But case numbers are still going up elsewhere in the world and signal a virus that is far from finished. Here with more on this and other recent stories is science journalist Roxanne Comsey. She joins us from Montreal, Quebec. Welcome back, Roxanne.
Hi, Ira. It's great to be back.
Nice to have you. Okay, let's get right into this. We really have seen a lot of COVID-19 protections taken down in the U.S. in the last couple of weeks. What reasons have been given for this?
Well, yeah, it's true. So recently the CDC said that 98% of Americans live in locations where you don't have to wear a mask indoors if you don't have any predisposing conditions that would put you at extra risk. And part of that's because they have determined that enough people have immunity. And they've also kind of changed the calculus in terms of what is a high-risk environment. So they've kind of higher the threshold of the number of cases that makes a place a high-risk location.
Yeah. It's not just the U.S. dropping protections either, right? Other countries have.
No, a whole bunch of countries have. The U.K. has. And, you know, Austria recently backtracked. There was a mandate that was about to go in effect for people to be mandated to be vaccinated. And recently lawmakers took a step back and said, actually, we're not going to enforce that. So there's definitely a walking back of restrictions and things like that in a lot of places, not just the U.S.
On the other hand, there are places where case numbers are definitely not going down. We're watching the numbers go up.
So absolutely. And this is happening in a lot of places where they had a COVID zero policy. So they'd really been successful in keeping the virus at bay for months and months and months. Someplace like Hong Kong, the highest number of cases of COVID that they had in a day last year was 60. And now they have tens of thousands of cases a day, and I think around 250 people a day dying, which for a place with not a huge population is an extremely high number. And China seems to also be perhaps heading in that direction, too. Hmm.
We'll have to look into that in great detail as we go on in the months. There's also a subvariant of Omicron beginning to circulate more widely, right?
Right, exactly. BA2. And I think what's interesting is there's been a huge consensus that it's more transmissible than the original Omicron variant. What seems to be still in debate is whether it's more dangerous. A lot of people say no, some people say yes. Yeah. But yeah, so we're not done with variants by any means. The story is not over at all.
Yeah, we're not done with the virus. We'll get into that a little bit later also. But let's move on to other infectious disease news, especially polio. Polio has been close to eradication for years now, but we're still not there, right? A few weeks ago, we talked about its reemergence in Mwali. Mwali, and now the Russian invasion of Ukraine may be further jeopardizing the end of this virus. Why is that?
Well, I think this is a really interesting and somewhat, in a way, sad story. I mean, so the polio eradication campaign launched in 1988, and it's possible because polio doesn't have an animal reservoir. Unlike SARS-CoV-2, it really just happens in humans, and of course can cause paralysis and really horrible effects. But by 2017, there were only 17 cases of polio in the world, which was a great achievement. And then in recent years, in places, particularly war-torn places like Afghanistan and other regions like that, it's been creeping up. And as you mentioned, in Ukraine, there was an uptick in polio where there were two kids that got paralyzed with polio not that long ago, the last case being in January. And it indicates that the virus is still circulating there. and that, you know, with only 50% of kids under one vaccinated against polio there, and the war now happening, just totally disrupting vaccination campaigns, there's a huge worry that this is going to set back this campaign to eradicate polio, which has, until recent years, been such a success story.
Yeah, because we do have very effective vaccines for it.
Absolutely. I mean, there's two different kinds of vaccines. One is given orally. It's like a drop in the mouth. And then the other one is a shot. And there's different strategies. The one that's given in as drops in the mouth is more feasible to be given in conflict regions. Of course, the downside is it's not quite as effective as the shot.
Right. We're actually going to go back to a story now that you brought us 2 months ago when it was reported that a man had received a heart transplant using the heart of a genetically modified pig. But the update is a sad one, is it not?
It is a sad one. And I'm really sorry to bring this news, but the patient David Bennett, who received the pig from, received the heart from a pig, unfortunately passed away this past week. And the doctors who did the transplant aren't quite sure what happened. They don't know if his body rejected this heart that had been so specially tailored to not be rejected by his body, by these genetic modifications in the pig that it came from. They're putting together a report, but, you know, for him, it was really like a last resort option. He was too sick to receive a human heart. So to be in a place on the wait list where he would receive a human heart. So this, for him, was kind of the last opportunity. Yeah. And unfortunately, it didn't work out.
We'll have to wait and see what, they haven't published their findings yet, but we'll have to wait and see for that.
Yes, absolutely.
On to something a little bit different. History nerds, we are excited this week at the announcement that the ship of explorer Ernest Shackleton has been discovered more than a century after it was lost to crushing Antarctic ice. I mean, I was someone who's been to Antarctica. That's all they talk about when I was there. It's how brave and smart he was. This is thrilling to see. And you know, there's video of this.
Yes. It seems surreal in some ways. I know we're on the radio, so people can't like see what we're talking about, but it looks like somebody just dropped it there yesterday when in fact it's been there for 107 years.
Yeah.
A part of me wonders if it's so well preserved because it's in this cold area, which is of course also why it was so hard to find. If you listen to the researchers who found it talking about the journey to like uncover where it actually was, they talk about, you know, snowstorms, ice storms, all sorts of elements that kept them from, you know, being in the right place to drop this device, this robotic device under the ocean to search. So so they've uncovered the endurance which Shackleton had set out with to try to traverse Antarctica after kind of missing out on being the first person to get to the South Pole. And 3,000 meters under the ocean, or the sea there, it sat for 107 years until today they found it.
It's only fitting that it took so much effort to get it because he took so much effort to save all of his crew. No one died in that rescue. It's an amazing story, but it's too long
it's
for us
amazing.
To tell. Go Google it. It's unbelievable. One last story.
It's amazing. I was just going to say they kind of camped out on the ice for months before they could get, you know, to safer ground with lifeboats.
And then there was this 800 miles trip in a lifeboat that went to an island where they could try to bring back some rescue people, and they did. It's an incredible feat. One last story, just in time for daylight savings, because that's happening this weekend. Who knew so quickly? You've got a story about Stonehenge.
Who doesn't love Stonehenge?
We all do, right? It's mysterious. We think it might have told time somehow, and now someone thinks they figured out exactly how. What's the deal here?
Right, and you're totally right. This is just perfect timing because we're all going to set our clocks back an hour, skip ahead an hour. I can never keep track of that. So Stonehenge used to be thought of as kind of built around the solstices, you know, winter and summer. But a reanalysis has looked at the stones and said, actually, this might be a solar calendar, kind of not too dissimilar from what we have today. We have 365 days and then a leap day every 4 years. This was 365.25 days, similar to what the Egyptians had figured out a couple centuries before.
Wow. I want to throw in a bonus story that you have for us today. That's something about researchers finally talking about sharks sleeping.
Sharks. Yes. The only kind of shark I ever want to encounter is a sleeping shark.
Well, you know, because I remember being a scuba diver that they said the sharks are sleeping. They're not moving, but they have to keep the water moving past their gills so that they can still breathe. But they do sleep. Is that what we're finding here?
Yeah. So this is a study that was done on a particular kind of shark known as a draftsboard shark, which gets its name from its checkered external, I guess, skin is what you'd call it. And scientists kind of had an idea that sharks slept, but they weren't really sure. No one had to put them in a tank to observe and find out. So they did this, and using certain physiological measures, like how much oxygen they were consuming, and also interestingly, their eye movements, they determined that when they were sleeping, they were using half as much energy as when they were resting, and also that they had a different position. So they were flatter when they were sleeping, as opposed to a little bit more upright. So they kind of had their torsos perked up when they were resting a little bit more, like one of these yoga positions.
I've heard it. I can't get it out of my mind. I'm going to think shark yoga next time I'm on my mat. and especially with breathing, right? That's what yoga is all about. We know that sharks
are... Yes, and resting. And resting and restorativeness, yes.
Terrific, Roxanne. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Great stuff.
Great. Talk to you later. Thanks, Ira.
Roxanne Kamsi is a science journalist based in Montreal. We have to take a quick break. And when we come back, how Russia's invasion of Ukraine has disrupted a multinational survey of wild salmon. And the scientists are trying to figure out how they can continue this without, without all the implications that it has working with Russia. We want also your calls about long COVID. We're going to be talking about it. Give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Do you have long COVID? Do you have people you know? We're going to have a couple of experts talking about it. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
KKUV Iowa News. Public Radio News.
Local science stories of national significance. A little over a month ago, scientists from the U.S., Russia, Canada, Japan, and South Korea embarked on a collaborative scientific survey to track wild salmon in the North Pacific Ocean. Then Russia invaded Ukraine, setting in motion, as you can imagine, a substantially more tense political situation to navigate. Yet despite the tension, scientists have opted to continue to collaborate in pursuit of understanding the recent fluctuations in the wild salmon population. Joining me now to talk about his reporting on the topic is Eric Stone, news director of KRBD, based in Ketchikan, Alaska. Eric, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Before we get into the details of this research project, let's start with some basics of a salmon's life cycle, okay, for those of us who might need a refresher. What is the salmon run?
Okay, so salmon spend part of their lives in freshwater and part of their lives in saltwater. They're what's called an anadromous fish. And basically what happens is they hatch from eggs in these rivers, and then they swim out to sea after fattening up just a little bit. And they spend a little while out there, generally 2 to 5 years, depending on the species, eating things like herring and squid and all kinds of stuff. And then towards the end of their lives, they swim back up the river to deposit eggs and fertilize the eggs and start the cycle over. And they can swim sometimes more than 2,000 miles in at least one river in Alaska.
Wow.
And as they swim up the river, they don't eat. It's remarkable. And in Western Alaska in particular, and, frankly, all over Alaska, these salmon are vital sources of food for indigenous people. People catch them in nets and fish wheels, and people catch them with rods and reels as well. It's an important cultural phenomenon. People construct these things called fish camps where they go and gather, their food source for the winter and catch all these salmon. And, not to mention, commercial salmon fishing is a huge industry here in Alaska that employs lots of people. It also feeds people all over the United States and all over the world.
And so there are lots of rivers in Alaska where the salmon are running, and maybe they fluctuate about the number of salmon that are migrating.
That's right. Yeah. So the salmon runs on these various rivers. They fluctuate in weird ways, and we don't totally know why. So I'll give you a few examples. Pink salmon harvests here in southeast Alaska were among the lowest in decades in 2020. And then in 2021, pink salmon beat the forecast by a good bit.
Wow.
King salmon stocks all over southeast Alaska are also in trouble. Like, fishing for any salmon near the mouth of a major river here in Ketchikan has been banned outright for years. But it's really in western Alaska where the salmon runs have been in crisis the most recently. So in 2020, the Yukon River chum salmon run faltered. Chum salmon is a species of salmon, one of the five Pacific salmon species. And then in 2021, the run totally collapsed. There were so few fish that people were not allowed to fish. And that's, you know, a large component of how people feed themselves. Authorities had to ban fishing up and down the river to preserve what little of the run remained. And it was a massive shock to people who depend on salmon, go to great lengths to replace it. One resident told Olivia Eberts of radio station KYUK in that area that he took his river-going skiff into the dangerous waves of the Bering Sea. But runs on the Kuskokwim River have also been faltering. Mike Williams Sr. of the Kuskokwim Intertribal Fish Commission, that's an organization that manages and researches salmon in the area, told me that he's worried about runs all over the region.
We depend on the salmon to sustain us through the winter. And we're very concerned about the returns of our salmon in all of the rivers in western Alaska.
And while the salmon run collapsed in that area on the Yukon River and is trending down on the Kuskokwim River, that same year in 2021, the sockeye salmon run in Bristol Bay, which is a giant commercial fishery, that set a new record.
That's amazing. So what you want to know and what the scientists want to know is why this wild fluctuation is going on.
Yeah, that's right. And the problem is we don't know. Most of the effort that's gone into studying salmon has been focused on what happens in freshwater, you know, where they reproduce.
Right.
Scientists think that issues happen in the open ocean while they're out fattening up. There has been some research and there are a few theories. I'll run through a couple of those. One is bycatch, the idea that salmon at sea are getting scooped up in the nets for sole and flounder or pollock, accidentally caught, more or less. Another is that hatcheries, basically there are these facilities where salmon are raised from eggs into, you know, juvenile salmon, and they're artificially enhancing wild populations. And one of the theories is that those artificially enhanced populations are outcompeting wild salmon. And then the third theory is that climate change is messing with the food web. That's, you know, warmer ocean, more acidic. So we know the ocean is changing, but not as much how the salmon are reacting to the condition. It's kind of a big black box.
What is the 2022 Pan-Pacific Winter High Seas Expedition? And how will it help test some of these theories?
So basically, it's a giant effort to study what happens in the black box of the open ocean during the winter. So vessels from three of the five countries you said at the top, the U.S., Canada, and Russia, they're out canvassing the North Pacific as we speak right now. They're putting a net down to see what kind of salmon there are. And the reason they're doing it during the winter is that winter is an especially tough time for salmon. There's not as much food, and this is where it's hypothesized that most of them die. So this is a good time to figure out what's going on with the population. So the idea is to give a better idea of how salmon are reacting with predators, with each other, with ocean conditions, kind of shine some light in that black box.
Yeah. Given the current political situation, is the survey going on as planned? Has there been any talk about not cooperating or eliminating Russia from this survey?
So I haven't heard any talk about, you know, cutting Russia out. They're doing a massive amount of work on this subject. And the survey is still going ahead. There have been some modifications. One, an interesting thing is that one of the survey vessels from Russia, the one that's covering an area that goes from about the middle of the Alaska Peninsula, so it's kind of even with the west coast of Alaska, all the way out to the almost the end of the Aleutian chains. They actually tied up in Dutch Harbor, that's the deadliest catch port, a day after Russians invaded Ukraine and started their assault on Kyiv. And now what happened is that a U.S.-based scientist was not allowed to board. So what happens now is that Russians are not allowed to survey within the 230-mile exclusive economic zone of the United States, basically, you know, waters close to the United States. And that is going to have impacts on the results of the study. Doesn't mean the mission is a failure, according to one of the scientists I talked to, but it means that salmon activity within that area near the Aleutian chain is going to remain a mystery for now. So I spoke with Bill Templin. He's Alaska's chief salmon scientist, and he told me the five-country commission has worked together in times of tension before. He said some Russian scientists actually included disputed islands in some salmon stock maps, and the Japanese had to politely ask him to change the maps. So he said that was all in good fun, but this is quite a bit more tension than usual. Even so, Templin told me that the salmon scientists are used to putting their work first and their political leaders' policies second.
The salmon all go to the same place. And so for all of us to work together to understand what's happening out there and the way it affects our nations, I think it's a pretty huge deal, and I'd hate to see it go away.
And you can actually track all of these vessels. There are four of them from the U.S., Canada, and Russia. They're all on a map at yearofthesalmon.org.
Wow, I think I'm going to do that. Thank you, Eric. Great report.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It was really a pleasure to be on.
Eric Stone, news director of KRBD, based in Ketchikan, Alaska. For the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about a topic that should be on a lot of people's minds, but likely isn't. I'm talking about long COVID. This is where folks who get COVID have symptoms that last for weeks, months, sometimes even years after their initial infection. Much of the country has rolled back mask mandates, thinking we've moved on from COVID. But there is a group of people who may have to live with it indefinitely. It's not over for them. Long COVID affects people in different ways. Some report debilitating fatigue or a persistent brain fog that makes it hard to concentrate. And for many long haulers, exercise and basic movement is not the same as it was pre-infection. There's still a lot we don't understand about the underlying causes of these symptoms, or why some people develop long COVID while others don't. Or could even a mild case or a symptom-free case of COVID lead to more debilitating illness later in life? Over the last 2 years, researchers have slowly accumulated more knowledge about the drivers of long COVID and how best to treat it. And that's what we're going to be talking about now. Joining me today are two people intimately familiar with long COVID. Let me introduce them. Dr. David Petrino, Director of Rehabilitation Innovation at Mount Sinai Health System in New York, New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
And Hannah Davis, co-founder of the Patient-Led Research Collaborative. She's based in Brooklyn. Hannah, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you. Dr. Petrino, are you seeing a surge of new long COVID cases as a result of the Omicron surge?
Absolutely. I think we're certainly seeing more cases coming through as a result of the Omicron surge. But I would also point out that many individuals are only just starting to get care now from some of the initial waves of COVID-19. So it often takes a little while for patients to get to us once they've been ill.
And have you been able to track it outside of the U.S. and in other countries?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that Hannah's work and the work of the patient-led collaborative has been phenomenal at this, but certainly we've been tracking the literature and that has been published in other countries and countries that have been putting out more work than the United States in actually trying to track across the entire country, and the numbers are concerning. You know, the most recent ONC report from the UK showed that 2%, an estimated 2% of the UK population has long COVID.
That's amazing. How likely are vaccinated and boosted people to get long COVID versus those who are not?
This is a tough question to answer. We certainly know that there is emerging literature to suggest that perhaps your probability of going on to develop long COVID is reduced post-vaccine. But the most up-to-date data that has been published on this matter still places it at a pretty high percentage. So the most recent estimates would suggest that in breakthrough COVID infections, that is COVID infections that are occurring in people who are fully vaccinated, there still appears to be around a 10% chance of going on to develop long COVID symptoms, which is very, very high.
Wow, yeah, wow. Let's take a question from a listener who sent us one through our VoxPop app.
I'm Deb in Portland, Oregon. I'm curious about whether the rumors that I've heard about sometimes vaccinations helping people who have long COVID to kind of reboot their systems and have their symptoms improve, whether that's true or not.
What do you say?
I think that's a great question. The way that we're currently viewing vaccinations and their role in long COVID symptoms is I view a vaccination as a symptom modifier. So some people are experiencing worsening symptoms. Other people are experiencing improvement in symptoms. And a larger majority of individuals don't really see a change in their symptoms post-vaccination. So this is interesting because it gives us some clue as to how some people with long COVID may have some immune underpinnings that are influencing their symptoms. And there's some phenomenal work happening under the leadership of Akiko Iwasaki out at Yale University looking into this exact question. But right now, I would not say that you can rely on a vaccine to improve your long COVID symptoms.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking about long COVID with Hannah Davis and Dr. David Petrino. And Hannah, let me go to you. Why did you decide to start the patient-led research collaborative?
So I'm a co-founder of it with four other patients who are in some context a researcher or data scientist or policymaker before getting sick. For us, we all got sick in March 2020 in the first wave. And at the time, there were no answers for us. You know, the CDC was still talking about this as something that didn't affect younger people, that everyone would recover from in 2 weeks if they weren't hospitalized. And we had all gotten sick and were still sick. And in April 2020, we're still sick and really had no clue what was happening. There was no public communication. And so we all joined the Body Politic support group, and it's on Slack. So there was a data nerds channel. So that really selected for people who were very curious and kind of looking for any data or any answer to explain what was happening to us. And one woman, Gina Asaf, decided to make a survey of all of the patients at that time, several thousand patients who were experiencing these symptoms. And I joined right when they had collected the data. So I offered my skills and my background was in machine learning. And, you know, we just wanted to get answers for ourselves at first. But right. At the time, that was the only data available. So we started getting calls from the CDC, et cetera, and then, you know, decided to keep continuing the research.
Why is it so important to have patients driving the research conversation?
I think especially for under-researched and poorly understood illnesses, doctors' hypotheses might not necessarily be the most accurate. Patients have the strongest understanding of the illness because they have lived experience of it. And this leads to knowing the right questions to ask in research. And so listening to patients and engaging in patient-led research helps speed research up overall because you can kind of focus on the areas that seem to be the biggest clues.
Do you think that healthcare officials were sort of ignoring long COVID patients, long haulers, from the beginning?
Yes, definitely. I think one of the things that bothers me the most is that we actually have so much evidence, including in the last SARS, including other viruses like EBV, that many, many viruses lead to long-term effects. You know, myalgic encephalomyelitis, dysautonomia are really common post-viral conditions. And this should have been integrated into the pandemic response from the start. And that just didn't happen.
All right, we're going to take a break. We want to hear more of comments that you have to make. We have a lot of people coming in on Twitter and on the phones. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, if you want to talk to our guest, Dr. David Petrino, Director of Rehabilitation Innovation at Mount Sinai Health System based here in New York, and Hannah Davis, co-founder of the Patient-Led Research Collaborative based in Brooklyn, 844-724-8255. So many questions. We'll see if we can get to as many of them as we can because this is a topic we have to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the phenomenon of long COVID with my guests, Dr. David Petrino, Director of Rehabilitation Innovation at Mount Sinai Health System here in New York, Hannah Davis, co-founder of the Patient-Led Research Collaborative. She's based in Brooklyn, New York. And I'm going to go to the phones, but before I do, I want to bring up an interesting point, I think, that's central to the issue here. And that is that the CDC recently relaxed mask guidelines, and many states across the country have followed suit. They've reverted back to pre-pandemic precautions as COVID seems to be going away. Dr. Petrino, should public health messaging and policies be more focused on long COVID?
Yes. I mean, in the strongest possible terms, yes. I think that from the outset, long COVID has been treated more like a shadow pandemic and less like an actual pandemic. People have not been giving it the level of attention it deserves as a mass disabling event in the United States. And the current sort of switch away from safe practice across the nation should be cause for alarm for everybody. Long COVID is very much a continuing issue that we need to be strongly concerned about. And we still need to strongly get out the message that death is not the only serious outcome of COVID, especially non-hospitalized COVID cases, these so-called mild cases mm-hmm. of COVID. There's nothing mild about an acute case of COVID right now.
Hannah?
I completely agree. I feel like the change to deprioritize masks just says that long COVID doesn't matter, and it's going to put so many people at risk who don't even realize that they are at risk, honestly, in many cases, because there's been such a lack of prioritizing and communicating about how serious long COVID is and how anyone, it can happen to anyone and completely, you know, mm-hmm. change your life, possibly permanently.
Let's go to the phones to Connor in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hi, Connor. Are you there? Oh, and who's on the phone? All right, let's see. Let's hope we're working the phones here and that they're working. Let me go to, let's see who else we can go to. Let's go to Audrey in Fairfield. Hi, Audrey, are you there? Audrey, are you there? Hi, Audrey.
I'm here. I'm here, yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I have a unique situation. I have what's called a prolonged concussion, which means I had two head injuries within 6 weeks. And I had COVID. My whole family had it the first week of September, or the 2 weeks. I had all the symptoms of my concussion, which were migraines. I couldn't remember things. It messes with your whole vestibular system. So I'm still have those side effects.
Does your physician take these things seriously?
Yes. What ended up happening is, come the middle of October, November, I was losing memory. I was getting lost. My eyes were getting weak again. My migraines were unbearable. So I see two neurologists, and I also am in cognitive therapy as well as eye therapy, which I had graduated from, but now I'm back in it. And my neurologist, as well as my eye doctor, have said there's no research about this, and they don't know the long-term effects.
Right.
And that is very scary to me. And I don't know if you know anything about that, or have you seen anything regarding concussions?
Let me ask my guests, Hannah, Dr. Petrino.
I would say that I'm not sure what the impact of COVID is, particularly on post-concussion syndrome, but long COVID is definitely very similar to post-concussion syndrome in that it causes many of the same symptoms that you just mentioned. I'm not sure if Dr. Petrino knows more than that.
Yeah, thanks, Hannah. I would tend to agree. And first of all, I'm just so sorry for what you're going through. That it does sound very uncertain and quite frightening. What I would say is that many of the symptoms that we see with long COVID can be often associated with what we call dysautonomia, which is a part of the nervous system called the autonomic nervous system, which controls a lot of things that are ordinarily under automatic control in the body, getting knocked out of balance. And we know that post-concussion syndrome often is also explainable by dysautonomia as well. And so it is very possible that you've experienced a flare of your existing dysautonomia as a result of your long COVID infection. Your physicians are correct in that we currently don't have a lot of research in people who had post-concussion syndrome and then got COVID to say that this is precisely certainly what is happening. But it does sound like you're getting good care, and there's a good chance that what we're looking at is a worsening of your dysautonomia.
Is it possible that you can develop long COVID symptoms without even knowing you have contracted COVID in the first place? Dr. Petrino?
Absolutely. We know for a fact that your chance of contracting long COVID is not correlated with the initial severity of your symptoms. So we have certainly seen many individuals who had an asymptomatic course of COVID-19 infection go on to develop long COVID symptoms, which is incredibly alarming when we consider the fact that it's hard enough right now to get insurers and other care providers to take long COVID seriously when you have a known case of COVID. But if you are an unfortunate individual who had an asymptomatic case of COVID and was unable to test positive or develop antibodies, as we know that many people with COVID do not seroconvert, you may find yourself in a really tough situation.
We have some tweets that are coming in. Shannon on Twitter asks, if you're not vaccinated, can long COVID effects be more serious or more likely?
Certainly more likely. We still don't know all of the factors that contribute to severity of long COVID symptoms, but we certainly know enough now that, you know, if you're unvaccinated, your chances of developing long COVID-like symptoms are more like 30%.
Wow. Let's go to the phones because we have lots of people who have questions. Let's see if I can go back to Connor in Harrisburg. Are you there, Connor?
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Hey there. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Long-time listener. I always enjoy listening to your show while at work. I have an interesting story. I'll keep it short. But I had COVID when it first came out. My mother went on a business trip, and she came back sick, and she didn't, you know, tell anybody. And I got it, and it hit me a lot harder than it hit her. And I was under the undercovers for 2 weeks, all the symptoms. Complete nightmare. And as I was recovering, it was very, very slow process. I was on a hike and I got bit on my arm by a tick. And I didn't think twice about it. And, you know, I've probably been bitten by a tick many times before. But instead of my health slowly going towards normal, it was going the opposite direction. I'm just wondering... could there be a relation, or
you think you got Lyme disease is what you're saying?
Oh no, I definitely have it, but yeah.
Did it affect just... COVID? Did it affect your long hauling?
Yeah.
Let me ask the doctors. Dr. Petrino, what do you think?
You know, we think about long COVID as an infection-associated illness, and some of the initial work that we're seeing coming out of some phenomenal immunology research labs, and in fact some of the work that we're doing ourselves is really pointing us toward the idea that many people with long COVID have changes to their immune system occurring, and one of those changes can be that. Some of our immune system that deals with making sure that we generate antibodies to fight off dormant infections that we have in our body, as well as fighting off new infections, can be impaired. And so we often see reactivation of old infection-associated illnesses. So many people who previously had had Lyme disease, but it's been quite dormant for some time, can experience worsening of Lyme symptoms. Epstein-Barr virus is another very common virus that people are experiencing reactivations of. And the list goes on. There are many, many previous viruses that can be reactivated by the immune sequelae of long COVID.
That's really interesting. That's something no one talks about. Could something like herpes, things like that, cause a recurrence?
Absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. Anything that was laying dormant can often be reactivated. And we I'm sure, you know, I'd love to hear from Hannah because she has way more data than we do. But
Well, I'm going to go to Hannah. Let me just give us a break. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Okay, Hannah, you've published two research papers tracking long COVID symptoms. What are the biggest takeaways here?
So for us, I think that in the beginning, we kind of helped show that long COVID wasn't just respiratory symptoms, that it was kind of cognitive, neurological, systemic, immunologic, the reinfections, like Dr. Petrino was just talking about.
Yeah.
Our recent paper, one of the biggest findings for me was actually that cognitive dysfunction and memory loss are in the top three frequent symptoms and happen as equally in 18 to 29-year-olds as in people over 60.
Wow.
And so, you know, in the beginning, we heard a lot about brain fog, but we really showed that it impacts the ability to drive, to take care of your children, to communicate, and especially to work. We found that 2/3 of people had to either reduce their hours or quit completely. And that didn't even include people who took early retirement because of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And then another really big thing we found was that, as Dr. Petrino mentioned, we have a very big issue with people who weren't able to get tests in the first wave. And even in recent waves, you know, Omicron had a lot of testing and accessibility. The CDC estimates that only 1 in 4 COVID cases have confirmation. We actually accepted people that were symptomatic positive and symptomatic negative and then compared them. And we found that the major difference between the two cohorts was not actually in the symptoms. This was looking at, you know, dozens of symptoms over time. But the date that they got tested after onset. So the positive cohort got tested at an average of day 6. The negative cohort got tested at an average of day 43. And so we try to communicate to people that having a negative test doesn't always mean they didn't have COVID. It often means they weren't able to access a test.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking with Hannah Davis and Dr. David Petrino. A tweet, this is a really interesting tweet from Maelstrom, who asks, are we going to have a huge population of people suffering debilitating symptoms?
Hannah? I think so, yeah. Definitely. I mean, from my perspective, you know, there's only a couple of places in the world that are tracking long COVID, you know, at the population level, and one of them is the UK. And they have found right now 2.4% of the entire population has long COVID, and that includes 4% of teachers and healthcare workers. And that's after 2 years of the pandemic. And we know that, you know, recovery can happen in the first 3 months, and after that, it's less likely. And if you get diagnosed with something like myalgic encephalomyelitis or dysautonomia or a lot of these other kind of clotting conditions, there's no evidence to show that, you know, that it's not lifelong. It's likely lifelong in many of these cases. And every year, if we're disabling, you know, 1.5% of our population, you know, which gets vulnerable every year, more vulnerable every year, because having a COVID infection in itself is a pre-existing condition. It looks, from my perspective, it looks pretty dismal.
Wow. Let me get one last question in for time. Beth in Neptune, New Jersey. Hi, Beth.
Oh, hi. I'm sorry. I lost you for a minute. So I have a sort of a complicated case, which I will really try to be succinct about. I have had I am hypothyroid since I'm 2 years old. I'm in my 60s now. And a lot of these symptoms mimic an underactive thyroid. And of course, I'm medicated and under the care of an endocrinologist. But I was in California President's Weekend when COVID was first starting with my daughter. And she came back and was diagnosed with COVID. And I never was diagnosed with it. I never had specific symptoms. And I didn't test for antibodies when I found out she had it. However, I can honestly say, and I'm a teacher, and my school started right back that September. So I've been in school for a long time with
Beth, I have to ask you to sum up what your question is.
So my question is, how do I know? Is there any way to know if it's my thyroid or COVID or long-term? Because all I have symptoms of brain fog.
Okay.
I've had palpitations,
I gotcha.
All of that.
Dr. Petrino, any answer to that?
Thank you for sharing that story. I think you've raised a very important point, which is at present, we do not have a good answer for you. It could be worsening of your thyroid condition, or it could be the case, as we were discussing earlier in the segment, that you had an asymptomatic case of COVID that has led into long COVID. What I can say is that we are working around the clock to try to come up with meaningful, concrete biomarkers of long COVID that can allow us to diagnose long COVID beyond a clinical diagnosis based on symptoms, but we're not quite there yet.
All right, we have run out of time. So many questions, so few time, so little time to answer them. Dr. David Petrino, Director of Rehabilitation Innovation, Mount Sinai School of Medicine here in New York. Hannah Davis, co-founder of the Patient-Led Research Collaborative. She's based in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you both for this valuable information today.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome. And if you want to find out how to join the long COVID support groups we've talked about or participate in the Patient-Led Research Collaborative Survey, go to sciencefriday.com/longcovid. That's sciencefriday.com/longcovid. Here's Kyle Marion Viterbo with some of the folks who helped make this show happen.
Thanks, Ira. Annie Nero is our individual giving manager. John Dankosky is our director of news and audio. Daniel Peter Schmidt is our digital producer, and I'm community manager Kyle Marion Viterbo. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Kyle. BJ Liederman composed our theme music. Thank you all for listening. I'm Ira Flatto in New York. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Later in the hour, we'll get you to love your sewage system. Yes. And we'll head back to Mars with our book club and search for life. But first, this week, President Biden tightened sanctions on Russia still more, cutting off imports to the U.S. of Russian oil. And it made me wonder, the rise of COVID-19, remember, disrupted the usual way research on vaccines are developed, the crisis speeding research development by up to months, if not years. Could this crisis of record-setting fossil fuel prices disrupt the normal way we do business with fossil fuels? Disrupt them enough so that renewable energy development is kicked into high gear also. Joining me now to talk about that and disruption in the energy economy is Dan Esty. He's the Hill House Professor at Yale University, Director of the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy, Co-Director of the Yale Initiative on Sustainable Finance. Welcome to Science Friday.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you. As I say, we've seen how COVID disrupted the development of cycles of vaccine, accelerating that cycle from 5 years to, 6 months? Can this same thing happen with renewable energy?
One of the things that we've really come to recognize in the energy and the world of focus on climate change is that the key to progress is innovation. So I do think a sustained effort to drive our technology development processes more quickly, to put incentives in place for breakthrough thinking and breakthrough innovation is possible. Whether we could shorten from 5 years to 6 months the innovation cycle, I'm not sure, but we certainly could do much more to really focus on the special opportunity we face right now to shift people off of a fossil fuel energy foundation onto something that is sustainable out over time, a clean energy base for the future economy.
I know that you're talking to us from Denmark and you have a good view on Europe. And Europe has been leading the world in switching to green energy. And the Wall Street Journal reports just now that, I'll quote from it, amid heightened fighting across Ukraine, the German Economic Ministry announced plans to speed up wind and solar projects as it seeks to curb its dependence on Russia for energy. You served in multiple administrations. How fast do you think this could happen, and what role would private industry need to take?
Well, I do think that there is a recognition in governments all across the world, with Germany perhaps most visibly demonstrating a changed spirit over the last few weeks, that we pay a price, a hidden price, for dependence on fossil fuels in multiple regards. The first price that we've known for some time is the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which is imposing ever greater costs on us. But over the last few weeks, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has highlighted a second price, a strategic vulnerability price. And I think the German government, in what represents one of the largest policy pivots of recent decades, has decided they cannot go forward with an energy future that depends on natural gas and oil from Russia. So it is quite clear that governments can change postures, and that, frankly, the pressure to do so from these multiple burdens that fossil fuels impose on us, a strategic burden, a vulnerability to rogue states like Russia, and, of course, the burden of an atmosphere that's filling up with greenhouse gases, threatening to create serious problems of climate change all across the Earth.
And it seems from polls, most recently the Quinnipiac poll, that cites 71% of Americans support a ban on Russian oil, even if it resulted in higher gas prices. So the American public may be behind this. Do you read that the same way?
I do think this is the moment to really shift gears in a fundamental way and move American society onto a more sustainable trajectory and to a clean energy future. I think if there ever were a time to have the public back change, including change that's going to have some price, it's now.
In the midst of this, the president has pointed to funding new hydrogen projects. I remember in the State of the Union, he talked about this. But at this point, that relies on natural gas, right, to make the hydrogen from that. Are we chasing the right clean fuels here? And why did the president focus on hydrogen at this point when so many people are focused on cars powered by batteries?
Well, I do think that there is a short-term opportunity to move to hybrid vehicles and ultimately to fully electric vehicles that exists right now. But the question is, where does the electricity come from for those vehicles? And in too many parts of America, it remains fossil fuel-based electricity. Connecticut and New England more broadly are quite lucky to the extent that we have significant not fossil-based electricity. So our shift would be more effective in terms of the transformation required. In terms of hydrogen, there are various colors of hydrogen. And you're quite right that a good bit of what is produced now is what's known as gray hydrogen, coming to us from natural gas. So we're splitting natural gas apart to get at that hydrogen. There are alternative ways using clean electricity to break water apart through electrolysis. And if we were able to do that, we would have a much cleaner base of hydrogen. As of today, that's still pretty expensive, but a lot of effort's going into bringing down those costs.
You're involved in something at Yale called the Yale Initiative on Sustainable Finance. Explain about how that might help influence the future direction of energy.
Well, at the Yale Initiative on Sustainable Finance, we are looking at ways that we can bring a flow of money, of capital at large scale, into investments that will help us move from where we are today to a clean energy future. And in particular, in the technologies required for deep decarbonization, which is what the world community now recognizes is essential. In fact, the core conclusion coming out of the climate negotiations in Glasgow in November, the so-called COP26 summit, was the need for net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. And if we're going to get there, we know we're going to have to bring a lot of money to bear to change out the fundamental infrastructure of our society. So we have a lot of capital that's got to turn over to be part of this transition to a clean energy future and really move us to a sustainable trajectory for our economy going forward.
How much do small investors, those without the multi-million or billion-dollar portfolios, influence this? Or is this really targeted at select few companies, corporations, industry leaders with a lot of sway or power, so to speak?
One of the things that's really come to the fore in the last couple of years is a growing number of mainstream investors, often pretty small investors, who have said to their investment advisors, to their pension fund managers, or to their 401k fund managers, that they want better alignment between their values and the stocks in their portfolios. And in particular, many are saying, we want a more sustainable portfolio. We don't want to be invested in fossil fuel companies. And to the extent that some are saying, we want to actively invest in companies that are seeking solutions to climate change, that are helping us move towards deep decarbonization. And those hundreds of thousands, now millions of relatively small mainstream investors, meaning they're not willing to forego returns, they still want to make a profit on those investments, but they're saying, give me a different mix of companies. Give me companies that are part of the sustainable future, and keep my money away from companies like oil companies that may in fact collapse in value over the next, if not 2 or 3 years, certainly 5 or 10 or 15 years, as society moves decisively away from fossil fuels and towards clean energy alternatives. But the most promising thing in some regards from my point of view is the fact that you've now got the corporate world absorbing this idea that we need net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, and hundreds, now in fact thousands of companies having made net zero pledges of their own.
Do you see any other disruptions that may emerge from this time period, given the role of Putin's petrostate in global instability and recent reports on climate change?
Well, I think we know that the climate science is getting ever clearer. Even in the last few weeks, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has produced its latest report focused on impacts and vulnerabilities and the need for adaptation. So we know there is a requirement that we take seriously the science, and that is going to require transformative change. And I think what is interesting to me is that this moment with Russia in high profile is added to the sense of momentum for bringing about this big shift towards clean energy and away from fossil fuel dependence. And basically, Putin has given us all a gift who need that added boost in terms of focus on the shift away from fossil fuels. He's added to the argument for freeing ourselves from dependence on something that has this hidden burden, this hidden set of costs.
Now, you're currently in Denmark, one of the world's leading wind power countries, and which has made that commitment to go green. Are we here in the States willing to trade the short-term pain, higher prices, for the longer-term gain in not only energy independence, but mitigating the effects of climate change?
So it is quite interesting in Denmark, where you see a quite different pattern to life. One can't help when flying into Copenhagen, but notice hundreds of windmills, particularly offshore, some onshore, but hundreds offshore that have become a significant part of the energy base for the country of Denmark. And on an everyday basis, you see people walking, commuting by bicycle. So there are quite different choices that are being made in the most sustainable countries in the world, and Denmark certainly is among them. But I think beyond that, it is important for us to recognize that there is an opportunity to shift gears, but it requires some willingness to pay a short-term price. And I think Americans may, in this moment, with the Ukraine issue and the suffering of the Ukrainian people evident, starting to realize that the price we would pay in terms of a higher cost for gasoline and short-term impacts on our pocketbook may well be so much less than the Ukrainians are suffering, and a signal of what is to come if we don't take action, that people are starting to step up and say, yes, this is the right time to shift gears.
Well, that is a good place to wrap it up. I want to thank you, Dan, for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. And thank you for bringing these issues to the fore.
Dan Esty, director of the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy and co-director of the Yale Initiative on Sustainable Finance. We need to take a break, and when we come back, we'll take a look at the miracle of modern wastewater systems and how we can make them even better. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I want you to think about your morning routine with me. maybe it goes something like this. Your alarm goes off, you head to the kitchen, grab a glass of water, then you head to the bathroom, use the toilet, brush your teeth, maybe take a shower. That very normal part of many people's mornings uses a lot of water. And where does that wastewater go? Well, for many of us, it's not something we really think about. We see it go down the drain and poof, it's gone out of sight, out of mind. But wastewater and sewage treatment systems are genuinely incredible, and they deserve our attention. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, wastewater treatment. Here with me to get us excited about the magic of wastewater systems and how we can make them better is my guest, Andrea Silverman, Assistant Professor of Environmental Engineering at New York University Tandon School of Engineering, based in Brooklyn. Welcome to Science Friday.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
I want to give out our numbers so our listeners can call in and ask questions about it. Because to me, this is a really fascinating subject. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. Yeah, that I say that because, you know, sewage treatment fascinates me. And I'm going to tell you a secret. I almost opted that to go to graduate school in the field. But I opted for radio instead. How's that working out? We'll see. But, I'm still really, really fascinated with it. So let's start with a simple vocabulary lesson, can we? What's the difference between sewage and wastewater?
Absolutely. And I should say that, wastewater also excites and fascinates me. So
good.
Thanks for having me in this conversation.
You're welcome.
Wastewater is a more general term. So wastewater can be thought of any water that results after being used by a process. So that could be domestic, agricultural, industrial, etc. Sewage is more specific. So sewage refers to domestic wastewater. And I often use the two terms interchangeably, and I probably will throughout the course of this conversation.
And so they do mingle at some point, don't they? I mean, we've heard of sewage systems that are overflowing and mingling with the wastewater system that flows out to the ocean.
Yeah, well, so sewage is the domestic wastewater. And right. In some municipalities, our sewage system is connected with our stormwater drains. And that's probably what you're referring to,
yes.
These combined sewer systems. And so that when it rains, you do have stormwater that ends up in our sewage system.
And so what ends up in our wastewater, though, is aren't they the things that we put on ourselves, our shampoos and lotions and things we put into our system, into our bodies?
Absolutely. I like to think of it as a couple of things all relating to what goes down the drain. So the first is anything that goes down the drain from what we put down the toilet to what goes in the sink. So it could be food scraps, oils, chemicals, if we're pouring paints or chemicals down the drain. Also things we wash off our bodies. So if you put lotions or gels on your body when you take a shower or bath, they're going down the drain. A big thing also that we think about with sewage is the things that we excrete, so feces and urine. And in addition to that fecal matter and urine, it's things that we ingest. So nutrients, we eat a lot of food, there's a lot of salt as well, that a lot of that goes through our body and we excrete them. Pharmaceuticals is another big class. When we take either pharmaceuticals or illicit drugs or whatnot, we're excreting often the parent compounds or a transformation product, a metabolite of that compound. And then another thing that we might be excreting is if somebody is sick, the pathogen or the organism that's causing that illness often is excreted as well. And then finally, the big thing that's in wastewater is water. We use a lot of water, and that water goes down the drain as part of that wastewater.
That is really interesting, all that stuff that we put into the wastewater.
Absolutely.
Let me move on to one of the big reasons wastewater has been in the news recently. And I'm talking about that all over the world, scientists are monitoring sewage for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the virus that causes COVID-19. Can you explain how this monitoring works for us? Because we've heard about it. How does it happen?
For sure. So the premise behind what we're calling either sewage surveillance or wastewater surveillance, or some people are calling it wastewater-based epidemiology, is that some of the compounds or organisms that we excrete can say something about our health. So the pharmaceuticals or these pathogens I mentioned that we excrete. Second of all, the whole community in sewered systems, municipalities served by a sewer system, the whole community is contributing to wastewater. And so we have had some issues throughout the course, for example, of the COVID-19 pandemic, where there have been periods of time where we haven't been able to test do clinical testing as adequately as we've wanted to. What's nice about wastewater surveillance is that everyone is contributing their excreta to that sewer system, so we're in essence sampling the whole community. So when we do wastewater surveillance, what we do is we collect a sample that we hope is representative of that community, and typically it's a what we call a composite sample that's collected over 24 hours. We then analyze and quantify that sample for SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19. And we've seen, in our sort of community working in wastewater-based epi, have seen that the virus concentrations in wastewater correlate to the case counts. And so that we're actually able to illustrate trends in COVID-19 prevalence through the virus concentrations that we're able to measure in these wastewater samples.
So it's pretty accurate. In predicting, right?
That's absolutely, yeah. And we're not able to necessarily say, okay, this many viruses means that this many people are sick, but we are seeing really good opportunity to see the trend. So you see an increase in viruses in wastewater, then you're expecting there's an increase in COVID-19 cases. And a decrease, corresponds to a decrease as well.
Let me go to our first phone call. Dan in Nellie's Ford, Virginia. Hi, Dan. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Just wanted to see what the prospects are for moving away from waterborne sewage, which was a very bad idea to begin with because you're wasting all your nutrients coming from the soil and washing them into the ocean, and ways to get it returned. But currently the contamination in sewage sludge is so bad it's basically hazardous waste and can't go back to the land.
Interesting point. What's your reaction to that?
Thanks for the question. One of the exciting sort of research areas in our field is in resource recovery. So how can we take the resources in human waste? And so that might be nutrients, as was mentioned. There's a lot of energy in human waste, and there's a lot of water. And I know that we were talking, the caller asked about water-free sewage systems, but if you do, water is still a resource in wastewater. But what are the ways that we can then take these waste products and not call them waste products anymore, treat them as valuable resources and process them to pull out those resources? So, we've done a bit of research looking at non-sewered, non-water-based sanitation systems. They actually make it a lot easier to recover nutrients in a lot of cases. One of the challenges is transport. So one of the big benefits of having a water-based wastewater system is that we can get all of the wastewater to our processing facility by gravity because it's flowing. When you have a non-watered system, you actually have to pick up and transport that solid waste or separated urine, which is one of the challenges.
Yeah. Let's talk briefly then about how wastewater is traditionally treated. Give me a moment, for example, in New York, where you work. How is the wastewater treated here? Give me the process it goes through, because I drive by West Side Highway and I see these treatment facilities and stuff. I want to know what's going on in there.
Absolutely. So a traditional treatment system has a couple steps. The first is a screening step. So we have a relatively wide mesh screen that removes the big stuff in wastewater. So you can think about wet wipes and leaves and condoms, unfortunately, and tampons, sometimes money or fish, whatever people flush down the drain that's pretty big or goes down the storm drain. After the screening step, there's a settling step. And one of the goals of wastewater treatment is to remove particles from wastewater. And so in that settling step, we have these big tanks that settle out the particles by gravity. After that step, the wastewater then goes to a process that's called activated sludge. And the goal of activated sludge is to degrade the organic matter in wastewater, which is another goal. There's a lot of organic matter, and if that organic matter goes into a natural environment, it could suck up all the oxygen in that environment because oxygen is needed to break it down. So in activated sludge, we rely on bacteria to eat up and break down that organic matter. And to do that, we aerate. We provide them the oxygen they need to do that. After activated sludge, there's another settling step to settle out everything that was created in activated sludge. And then the final step is disinfection. And typically is chlorine that's used. And that disinfection step really is trying to prevent transmission of waterborne pathogens to the environment.
So that when that's all done, it just gets flushed out into the river if you're living in a city where there are rivers, or out into the ocean?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, there's a lot of water, and it doesn't just disappear. So we have to put that effluent, that water effluent, into whatever surrounding water body is nearby. And one thing I do want to note is that sometimes those water bodies become the drinking water sources for other communities. And so that's why wastewater treatment is so important. It's one of those barriers that we use to prevent that transmission of yeah. illness or disease to another community.
You know, in this whole process, I did not hear a step for taking out all those drugs and pharmaceuticals we put in the water through the toilet.
Absolutely. There's a couple of things that traditional treatment facilities aren't able to remove. And it's not because we don't care about them. It's just that when these systems were designed, we weren't thinking about certain things. One of those things is pharmaceuticals. And so we don't have, some pharmaceuticals are removed, but there's a number that the processes just aren't in place for their removal. And another is nutrients. Traditional wastewater treatment facilities do not do an great job at nitrogen removal, for example. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to target these compounds, what you'd have to add on is what we call advanced treatment processes. And there are some facilities that do have these advanced processes in place, but it's not all of them.
It's expensive.
It's very expensive.
Yeah, that's the way. Unfortunately. When I was studying this in college, it was called tertiary treatment. And
it still is tertiary or advanced.
And it was always had the big money signs around it. That's why we don't have them in very many places. Let's go to Jeff in Wichita. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I live in Wichita, Kansas, and I bought a kayak once about 6 years ago and tried to, like, recreate in the Kansas River, and it was just like a sewage pond. It's just total waste. And then I lived in Europe, and you can go to these major rivers and they're clean. How can we clean our rivers in America with all the runoff and the sewage that goes into them? Yeah. How can we do better?
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff. How do we do that?
I mean, wastewater treatment is really one of the important barriers there. So in the United States, we have the Clean Water Act, and that's the regulation that's meant to protect our water resources. And it's done an incredible job. So a lot of our wastewater treatment facilities were built in response to that act that was put in place in the 70s. I don't know exactly what's going on in Wichita and why the treatment facility is not working, but I do think that wastewater treatment really does help provide that barrier.
Okay, this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking with Andrea Silverman, Assistant Professor of Environmental Engineering at NYU Tandon School of Engineering. And I think we have time for a really interesting another call. Let's see if we can get this one in from Nick in Kentucky. Hi, Nick.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm an operator here in Kentucky, and I just wanted to say that give a thanks because a lot of operators don't get a thank you for what they do. And I was told in my class to get my operator license that we're protecting the environment and protecting the people, I mean, from diseases and stuff. And just wanted to say, you know, I mean, a lot of our job is dangerous, like, especially when it comes to having to change out chlorine tanks and sulfur tanks, you know, because the sulfur takes chlorine out of the water. It's just a dangerous job all around. All right. Just kind of wanted to say, thank you to other people. So
let's throw some love to Nick. Thank you, Nick.
Yeah. And thanks for calling. I'm so happy that you called in. I really am so appreciative of operators. You guys are incredible. You are protecting public health. And like you said, I don't think enough people know the hard work that you do to allow us to live the way we do.
Let me see if I can get a quick call in from Brendan in Rhode Island. Hi, Brendan.
Hi, how are you?
Quickly.
Good. Yeah, I'm a graduate student at the University of Rhode Island for the hydrology department. So I absolutely love what you guys are doing. I appreciate it. The question I wanted to bring to the table was, what do you guys kind of expect for future considerations when we have increased populations, if there's going to be an increased load on the nutrients, and what do you guys kind of expect going forward?
Good question. I see why he's a student. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that has to definitely be taken into account. So when thinking about population growth, you definitely have to plan your facilities in that way. And I agree. I think nutrients are going to be an ongoing challenge for us. And so there are certain facilities that are upgrading to have what we call biological nitrogen removal, to be able to target nitrogen specifically, to try to protect our waterways.
If I'm going to give you a blank check question, which, you know, I don't have the money, but I'll make believe I do. If you had a blank check and you could spend it on upgrading all these sewage systems, is there enough money in the world to upgrade all the sewage systems that need to be upgraded? And what would you do en masse for most of them?
I think there's enough money, and I think what I would do is shift the focus to resource recovery. So can we create energy products? Can we create fertilizers so that we don't have to be making synthetic fertilizers? And can we reuse the wastewater, especially in places that are water limited? I think that resource recovery really is such an exciting opportunity for the next generation of wastewater treatment facilities.
Do you need to develop new filtration systems?
Yeah. So, you know, as mentioned, there's a lot of things in wastewater we need to manage. So there's a lot of research going into things like advanced oxidative processes that can help break down pharmaceuticals and viruses so they don't become a health risk. Membrane filtration to try to also remove potential contaminants to make sure that we're doing this in a safe way. Because still remembering that, you know, that direct reuse of, let's say, wastewater, there can be some constituents that can cause health impacts. So we do need to keep working on research to come up with efficient ways to remove them.
And quickly, what can we do at home to help you?
Don't flush things down the toilet that shouldn't be flushed. Anything that you'd imagine, like when you flush big things down the toilet, the screen is the first thing in the treatment facility. It gets stuck on a screen, and then the operators have to physically remove it from the screen and throw it in the garbage, and it goes to the landfill. So just imagine anything that you put down the toilet is eventually going to a waterway. And if you don't want it to go in that waterway, don't flush it down the toilet.
All right. Great words. Thank you, Dr. Silverman, for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Andrea Silverman, Assistant Professor of Environmental Engineering at New York University Tandon School of Engineering in Brooklyn. We have to take a break. And when we come back, we're heading out to Mars with the book club and asking what it means to be alive. What is life all about anyhow? Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Time now to turn to the Science Friday Book Club, The Sirens of Mars. That's what we're reading. It's all about the centuries-long fascination with the red planet and its potential for life. You can learn more about how to join us in reading and discussing this book. Yeah, it's at our website, sciencefriday.com/bookclub. Joining me now is my favorite Martian producer, Christy Taylor, here with War Cools Mars Science. Hey, Christy.
Hey there, Ira.
Now, last week we talked about clues in Martian meteorites. What's the update today?
Well, we've been asking listeners to weigh in on what they thought about life on Mars. This is all on the Science Friday Vox Pop app. And there's Tim from Scottsboro, Alabama. He thinks the planet once definitely had life.
But I think in our present day that it's just a bleak, lifeless desert.
And then we had Kevin in Tulsa, who thinks life might actually still be there.
I think somehow, way in the distant past, Mars was in the Goldilocks zone and had liquid water. I think microscopic life from that time is trapped in the polar ice cap.
And that Goldilocks zone he's referring to, by the way, is the sweet spot around a star where a planet can count on having liquid water.
Not too hot, not too cold, just like the porridge.
Just like the porridge.
But what are we talking about when we talk about this word life? I mean, couldn't there be other unfamiliar life forms out there? And how would we even know what to look for?
That is such a great set of questions, Ira, and there's actually a whole group of astrobiologists who are asking those same things, too. Mars is actually a lot like ancient Earth, but beyond Mars, there are some really wild moons and exoplanets that could host some really weird stuff. So to talk through these questions, I brought in some scientists who are also using their imaginations a lot, and in this case, I'm talking about science fiction. Dr. Moya McTeer is an astronomer and folklorist, and she hosts the ExoLore podcast, which is all about inventing fake life on real planets. And Dr. Mike Wong, a postdoctoral fellow at the Carnegie Institution for Science, He's got a podcast, too. It's called Strange New Worlds, and he talks about the science of Star Trek. And I started by asking Mike to talk about his day job, which is looking for traces of life in planetary atmospheres.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I do. So we are discovering exoplanets by the bucket load these days. These are planets orbiting other stars. And the only conceivable way to try to assess whether there is life on those worlds as of right now, given the technology that we have at the moment, is to try to identify the molecular fingerprints of atmospheric gas molecules that life has sort of breathed out into the atmosphere. And the way we look at this is basically as the planet orbits its star and passes between its star and us, that starlight will filter through the atmosphere and enter our telescopes. And because of the specific ways in which molecules of gas absorb that light, we can actually get a handle of what's in that atmosphere. And if we detect certain combinations of molecules that look really intriguing, because they are tied to our theories for what life should do in that planetary context, then maybe we'll even get a hint that there is a biosphere on that planet.
Mike, I know as an astrobiologist, you're probably spending a lot of time thinking about biosignatures, but I, in my past research endeavors, have also spent some time thinking about technosignatures. So I guess I would push back a little bit saying that we can only detect life by looking for these molecules and other compounds that we think would be formed by biological processes. There are also some technical signals that we might be able to find.
Okay, but what is a technosignature and what would it look like?
Yeah, so similar to biosignatures where you're looking for a signal or something that would only or mostly exist in the presence of biological processes, a technosignature is something that we think would happen because of a technological civilization. Then there have been a few papers coming out over the last decade looking for different types of technosignatures. One that you might be familiar with would be a Dyson sphere. This is a big structure that an alien civilization might build around their star to capture all of its energy. But you can also imagine smaller scale things like there was a paper that came out a few years ago looking for nightlights on planets using something similar to the transmission spectroscopy that Mike was talking about. But instead of looking at the spectra of light, it's really just looking at the amount of light. If a planet has more light on its dark side than we expect to see, then maybe that's a hint that there are bright city lights on that planet.
Mike, we just went straight for the jugular, technological societies. What's your take on that?
Well, I sit here in my closet, absolutely corrected. You know, technological societies is a really interesting point that maybe we can think of them as a natural emergence in the course of a living planet's history. But it's also something that has arrived here on Earth relatively late in our planet's history. Animal life on Earth has existed only within the last tenth of Earth's history. And then technological civilization has been around for, depends on who you talk to in terms of anthropology and when they date the beginning of civilization as we define it here on Earth, but it's definitely less than 1 million years. Mm-hmm. This is a blip in Earth's history. And I think what we might say as astrobiologists is that the idea that we could potentially detect life out there that is simply biological life, maybe even just microbial life, is potentially a lot greater than finding evidence for technological life, because it is easier for that kind of simple life to emerge in multiple places. Mm-hmm. However, I absolutely agree with Moya that if we get technological civilizations out there, the signals, those flares that we would see from them as a result of all of their technology would be so much more obvious to our telescopes.
I want to take us a step backwards, though, because here we are, we're talking about highly sophisticated technological societies. Meanwhile, on Mars, the rovers are hunting for evidence of basically ancient bacteria. So when we're talking about the definition of what life could be, I remember way back in high school biology, some of the basic characteristics we were taught about life involve things like reproduction, metabolism, life responds to its environment. And NASA's definition of life is just a self-sustaining chemical system capable of Darwinian evolution. Can definitions like that help us in this search?
I think yes, by definition. They will, because you when you're looking for something, you have to at least have an idea of what you're hoping to find. But I think it's also really important to be open to the idea that what you find might not look anything like what you expect, especially when we're talking about extraterrestrial life, that if it exists, would be adapted to their own local environment. And I, based on the amazing diversity of planets that we have found, I think it, you're right, Mike, it is like up to 5,000 by now. These planets are so different, which means the life on these planets would be so different.
Moya, I know one of the things that you have spent time researching is whether we can tell how bumpy an exoplanet is.
Yes.
That's the technical term. Why is this important in the search for life?
So there's some evidence that mountains and other topographical features like volcanoes and trenches are a good proxy for how habitable the planet is. These mountains and other features will form through internal mechanisms that are really useful for life. Having plate tectonics, the ability to cycle material in and out of the interior of a planet, helps with things like regulating the amount of carbon dioxide in an atmosphere or other molecules, whatever that planet has. This plate tectonic process is really good for cycling. Even having volcanoes is a sign that your planet has internal volcanism. So if your planet is outside of the circumstellar habitable zone, if it's farther from its star, it might still be okay if it has this internal source of heat.
So this reminds me of a paper that just came out recently from my colleague Stuart Bartlett, who was trying to identify a way to calculate the complexity of a planet, especially an exoplanet that we are just observing as a single pixel in our telescopes very far away. If you have mountains, if you have a habitable planet with constant tectonic motion, the complexity of that planet's surface is going to go up. And so what Stuart and his colleagues did was they figured out a way to like observe the Earth and also observe Jupiter, another very complex world in our solar system. And what Stuart and his colleagues found was that the Earth is way more complex than Jupiter. Although by eye, you know, I look at Jupiter's storms, all those beautiful images that the Juno twin is beaming back to us, and I look at those swirls and, you know, pinkish and reddish and orangish cloud features, and I'm like, that's a complex world, but it has nothing on the Earth.
I'm not surprised by that, actually, but that sounds like a really cool paper.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about the ways in which life as we don't know it may or may not manifest. And I want to do that through the lens of science fiction, since that's a place in our culture where we often let our imaginations run quite wild. As far as that question is concerned, you two are both podcast hosts as well as scientists. You think about this a lot. Why is science fiction an important way to conceive of life beyond our understanding?
One of my favorite instances of life elsewhere in science fiction is the Borg from Star Trek.
Ooh.
So for those listeners who are not familiar, the Borg are basically this collective of cybernetically integrated individuals who are all linked to a hive mind. And I just love them because they show an alternative form of learning through assimilating other civilizations' technology and biology and making it a part of their own. So this is different from what we think of as strictly Darwinian learning, you know, this descent with modification that Darwin described. And it's actually a little bit more akin to horizontal gene transfer. You basically let others innovate and generate novelty, and then you kind of just steal it from them. I really think that information and information processing and information transfer is at the heart of what it means to be alive. But anyway, I just love the Borg because they are basically a warning to us about where we might be going as a technological society. And I think it's worth putting into perspective, again, that our technosphere, or our data ohm, as some might call it, is a result of 4 billion years of biological evolution. It's a part of life on Earth, but it's an emergence on our planet that has never before happened in the history of all of Earth. And so we've got to turn to science fiction to try to predict its outcomes.
Yeah, that's a great example, Mike. I love that you brought up the Borg, because I think that one of the purposes of science fiction is to let us humans work through some of our deepest societal issues and things that we have a hard time grappling with here on Earth when we're talking about human experience. But when you separate it from humanity, when you put it on another planet or with another species, it makes it so much easier to deal with.
Yeah, the same is true about astrobiology. When we look for life out there, we are also asking, what even are we that we are looking for something out there that resembles us? When we ask about the origin of life, we're asking about our own story. When we are asking about the habitability of other worlds, we can't help but also turn around and look at how we are disrupting the climate and the habitability of our own. Astrobiology is like science fiction in this way. It is a mirror for ourselves. By thinking about these hard questions out there, we are also thinking about hard questions in here.
Moya, Mike just mentioned the Borg from Star Trek. I know on your Exolore podcast, you ask questions like, what kind of life could live on a planet that was mostly volcanoes? And I think that one involved shiny turtles with precious metals in their shells. Is that how one might go about imagining life? Take a real set of physical conditions and try to imagine what might survive there?
That's my process. I have talked to other world builders. These are people who build imaginary worlds, usually for the purpose of putting a story in those worlds, but not always. And my personal process starts with imagining the intention that you have for your world, and then building out the physical environment, and then going to biology, and then going to culture, because that's how our world happened. That's how worlds in nature are built. And so I feel like it's just nice to follow that same path. So many world builders have their own processes, but I think it makes sense to start with the environment because I use my world building as a vehicle for science communication and getting people to better understand the facts that have underpinned our own world here on Earth.
Just a quick reminder that this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking about how we imagine life, and I mean alien life that we've never seen before. Mike Wong, Moya McTeer, where do you want to go looking for life in our solar system?
Okay, well, you know, with all due respect to Mars, I'm going to go for Team Europa here. So just for context, Europa is a moon of Jupiter. And because of the tidal forces that it experiences, its interior gets heated to the extent that there is a global ocean of liquid water hiding underneath of this kilometers thick ice crust. And the cool thing is that that water is in contact with rock on the bottom of that ocean. And one of the leading theories for the emergence of life here on Earth situates our emergence at submarine hydrothermal vents. So I really find Europa this great possibility for life on a world that is very differently oriented than the Earth. You know, we have these oceans in contact with a brilliant atmosphere that feeds us carbon dioxide and everything. Europa has no such thing, but it still could be alive, and it would be really groundbreaking if we did find life there.
Moya?
I agree 100%. I think that there's a long history of people being kind of more obsessed with Mars and its potential for life than we should be. And Mike's totally right that Europa is more interesting from that perspective. I love the idea of this world where dimensions don't work in the same way. So I often have a lot of fun imagining entire worlds built in an ocean. I did an episode where I imagined life on a planet or on a moon like Europa. And because they have that thick ice sheet at the top, what you end up with actually is like upside down ice mountains that dip down into the water. And you also have features at the bottom with the rock. And so I just love that imagery. We ended up imagining like giant matriarchal squid societies. And yeah, so Europa is super cool.
Wow, awesome.
That's excellent. I think the takeaway I'm getting here is that life, it's complicated.
Yeah.
Moya, Mike, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for your great questions.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Mike Wong is a postdoctoral fellow at the Carnegie Institution for Sciences, Earth and Planets Laboratory, host of the podcast Strange New Worlds. And Dr. Moya McTeer is an astronomer and folklorist. Her podcast is called Exolore.
Thanks so much for this complex conversation, Christy.
Thank you, Ira.
And listeners, are you reading The Sirens of Mars with us at the Sci-Fry Book Club? you can hear author and planetary scientist Sarah Stewart Johnson talk about her work. Maybe ask her all about it. Just come to our next Zoom call-in event. It's a behind-the-scenes Q&A that you can join before it airs on the show. Check it out at sciencefriday.com/Mars events. And that's about all the time we have for this week. If you missed any part of this program or you would like to hear it again, yes, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow.